Hello and welcome to the Policy Pod. I'm Suzanne Woodward from the Public Policy Institute, and with me today is Alistair Jones. Alistair is an assistant professor in qualitative research methodology at the London School of Economics and an associate at LSE Cities. He's the director of the MSc Social Research Methods and specializes in teaching research design and qualitative research methods. He's visiting the University of Auckland on an International Visitor Exchange Scheme grant from the National Centre for Research Methods in the UK. Welcome, Alistair. You are here in Auckland working on a project looking at methods for evaluating public policy, on how to conceptualize the integration of qualitative methodologies and data into policy evaluations. Could you tell us a bit more about this project?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a qualitative researcher by background, but in the past I've worked on mixed methods evaluations of policy interventions. And I'm also working on a process evaluation at the moment. So I'm interested as a methodologist in evaluation and in the use of qualitative research methods in evaluation studies. And so what I want to do in this particular study, which is kind of a desk-based study, is to understand better how people who do these sorts of evaluations actually in practice utilize and harness their qualitative research methods to better understand the outcomes that they're interested in, the systems that they're interested in, and the interventions that they're interested in.
And why do you think that multi-strategy approaches are particularly useful for policy evaluation?
In health research, which is part of my background, so public health research, randomized control trials are held up as the kind of gold standard for experimentation, for understanding the effects of interventions or changes on a system and on outcomes. But in policy settings and policy contexts, often we can't do that. These are interventions that are applied to whole populations. For me, it's in cities. I'm interested in kind of urban settings. And then we start to kind of move towards observational studies where we don't have this capacity to randomly intervene and control for different parts of a population. And so instead, we're doing observational studies or natural experimentation on existing settings. And that's the case with policy settings. So then what do we do? When we have a kind of policy intervention, how do we understand the effects of that intervention? And here, I think we can start to bring in multi-strategy designs to start to empirically to quantify the effects of a given intervention, but also to understand the mechanisms of that change using qualitative methods, for instance, to help us to fill in some of the gaps that the quantitative work can't do. And also, I would argue, to do some additional work to understand the capacity of that intervention to have a particular change in a particular context, say in an urban context.
So I believe you're drawing largely on a study that you were involved in that sought to evaluate the public health impact of a transport policy intervention in London. And that study, called On the Buses, was funded by the National Institute for Health Research to look at the ZIP scheme. So what is the ZIP scheme?
So the ZIP scheme is a concessionary transport scheme fare for young people in London, for 12 to 17 year olds in London. So they effectively removed the need for kids to pay to get onto buses, and also the kind of relatively limited tram network in London. So the ZIP card enables young people to use buses, school children to use buses in London for free. And it's a universal scheme, so it's not means tested, it's universally applied. So if you're between 12 and 17 years of age, and I think it also applies to older children who are still in education, you get this free bus scheme, and the ZIP card is just like the Auckland Transport card you have here in New Zealand. It's just a card you can have in your wallet, and you just put it on the automatic scanner and it gives you that free transport.
And what were the key aims of the scheme?
So the key aims of the scheme, so the kind of explicit aims were to reduce transport poverty and to reduce car dependence in the kind of future for these young people. In terms of reducing transport poverty, to essentially give people more opportunities to access education beyond their school, to access social activities, so sports activities and so on, or other social activities they might do in the city without kind of being economically restricted in what they could do in the city.
Some of the positive perceptions around the scheme were to do with increasing school attendance and independence. And those are obviously things that are, school attendance is something you can measure quite easily using hard data. Increased independence is obviously something that's quite a lot more difficult to evaluate. So is this is a case of where this mixed methods might work to try and give you a better picture of how the policy is working?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the kind of principles of the study was that we drew up a logic model for how we hypothesized the intervention would work. So we were specifically interested. So school attendance is absolutely something that might be an effect, but we were interested in the kind of health impact of this particular scheme. And so we hypothesized in conversations with transport commissioners, with policymakers, and with other academics, trying to hypothesize, okay, what are the relationships between this intervention, between kids getting their free bus travel, and what the particular outcomes of that might be. So one of the ones that was kind of in the media at the time was, okay, of course, this is going to lead to an obesity crisis because young people are going to be walking less. So this was one of the things. Will it reduce active travel? So walking and cycling, as we kind of conceptually think about it, among this population. But we also argued there would be other health benefits and health disbenefits. So we thought there might be increased exposure to crime, for instance, on the bus network. There might be increased exposure to road traffic injury by having more kids out on the streets. There might also be increased social inclusion, as you mentioned, which would be a benefit. So we're trying to map out these pathways, and then we could identify what data we could use to evaluate each of those pathways. And often you had, as you said, you have hard data for this. So we could use Transport for London, which is a transport authority in London. They have a lot of data on travel diary data on how young people are travelling, a kind of sample of young people in London are travelling. So they keep diary data, so we can use that data to look at the change in their kind of travel behaviour. We have hospital episode statistics, so kind of admissions to hospitals, and we can start to see if there's a change in road traffic injuries among young people in London before and after that intervention. We had Stats 19, which is police data on crimes. So we can use that hard data to evaluate some of these things. But other things, as you said, so social inclusion is harder to measure, or what the young people are using these bus travel schemes for, and also what their attitudes to car use are subsequent to having a free bus scheme. So is there a change in that? That's very hard to measure using existing data. We can't predict those things, and this is very hard. So we're using the qualitative data, we're kind of bringing it in to, in some ways, fill in some of these gaps. And that's a kind of classic approach to mixed methods evaluation. It's okay, so what, we can't get these things. These things are hard to assess using the hard data we have, the statistical data we have, the numbers we have. And let's use some qualitative data. But we argue that as well as kind of using the qualitative data in that deductive way, where you're kind of filling in gaps, you're using the qualitative data to explain some things that you're missing in your quantitative data, or to explain relationships that seem to pertain, you're also using the qualitative data in a more inductive way, so kind of from the ground up, to understand just what is actually going on. Let's talk to these young people, let's find out how they're using these bus passes, and find out what the effects of it are more broadly. And then we can maybe start to understand how, for instance, it's changing their attitudes to car use, how it's changing their perception of what it means to use a bus. So, for instance, one of the things that we found is that bus use didn't seem to be stigmatized for these young people. This wasn't something that less well-off people got, or people who couldn't afford a car, or people who lived in particular parts of town. In fact, the way they talked about bus use was that everyone uses the bus. Kids use the bus. People going to work use the bus. Older people use the bus. Women use the bus. Men use the bus. It didn't have this kind of stigmatized representation in our data, in our qualitative data. So we're using that qualitative data in a more inductive way to start to understand what's going on in this system. And that's a kind of interesting finding, that it's not a stigmatized mode of transport. And then you could start to make claims, well, actually, perhaps this intervention would work in instances where there isn't a stigmatisation of bus use, for instance, or it's not seen. Whereas in some settings, bus use is absolutely, well, that's, I'm not going to get a bus to work. Don't be ridiculous. That's, I'm going to drive or whatever it might be. So that's kind of one of the things we argue that you could start to use the qualitative data, not only to fill in the gaps in the quantitative analysis, but also to start to think more inductively and to understand more from the ground up, from the bottom up, from the perceptions of young people from their accounts, build up a picture of what this bus scheme actually does. And then you can hopefully start to interpret your quantitative data in a more accurate or a more valid way that kind of fits in the accounts of the young people as well.
So I think it's really interesting, this concern around the obesity and the decrease in active transport that might have occurred as a result. So what were your findings in terms of whether that was the case or not?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting part of the analysis. So the quantitative data, it was kind of in this context of transport, people in transport in London saying, okay, we think the risk is that it's going to lead to a decrease in active travel, more people getting the bus, doing less walking, doing less cycling. And what we found is that people were doing more short trips by bus, absolutely. There was a decline in cycling as well among young people. But in fact, the distances that young people walked showed no significant decrease. So people weren't walking any less in terms of the distance they covered after the introduction of this scheme than they had been before. And this was counterintuitive. Why do we see this increase in short trips by bus, but we don't see this change in the amount of walking people are doing? And so one of the things we use the qualitative data for is to try to better understand that causal link, or that the mechanism that meant that this free introduction didn't lead to a decrease in walking. And actually, when you spoke to young people, you realised that they were using the buses for additional trips to ones to just going to school. So the scheme works 7 days a week, all year round. It's not just for school days. And then they're doing discretionary travel before and after school. They're going to different places. They said they just use the bus to go and just be on the bus to go somewhere that they hadn't been to before, or to go to social activities that they wanted to go to. So the bus kind of enabled these additional trips. But of course, when you take a bus or you take a tube or you take a train, you walk to the train station, you walk to the bus stop, and you walk at the end of it. And so there is active travel as part of public transport journeys. So you can think of a journey as a kind of sequence of trips, and part of that is walking and part of it is sitting on the bus. And then another intriguing thing is actually for young people, buses weren't seen as this kind of passive mode of transport where you're just sitting down. They're an active thing. They're standing, they're chatting at the bus stop. Of course, they can get on a bus and they can jump off at any point and get on another bus if they want, because they don't have to pay another fare. So there's not this kind of decreasing return. So they don't have to just keep paying for additional fares. So often what they'd say they did is they see their friends on the bus behind, or they'd know they're on the bus behind. They get off the bus, then they'd walk to the next bus stop. They get on their friend's bus and so on. So the journey becomes an active journey as well on the bus. So we have evidence of public transport journeys involving active travel, so getting to and from the bus stops. But also we have evidence of these kind of independently mobile journeys by bus being active in themselves. There's kind of active components of those. And actually there's an interesting study in Auckland that found, this was published in 2016, that found that independent mobility among young people, so this capacity to not be dependent on kind of driving or your parents driving you, independent mobility in itself is linked to kind of more vigorous levels of physical activity. And this is what our qualitative findings suggested as well. We weren't able to measure it. So in the New Zealand study, they used accelerometers. They were actually kind of tracking what young people were doing. We didn't do that for individuals, but that's a great kind of additional insight. But our data was suggesting that yes, these journeys are actually active in and of themselves. So ultimately we could understand why a free bus intervention wouldn't necessarily lead to a decrease in the distances that people were walking. It was generating additional journeys, and those journeys had an active walking component. And so the distances people were walking kind of stayed the same statistically.
Yeah, there was one lovely comment from one of your interview participants who talked about just seeing a park on the bus and stopping and getting off and spending the afternoon in the park. And that, I suppose, is the kind of stuff that doesn't come out in the hard data, that you need the qualitative research to contribute to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the other interesting things, and this was a really important finding, is that the zip card scheme was universal. So it applied to all young people, regardless of their family income or whatever. So it was a universal scheme. And actually what a lot of the young people were telling us is that for them, travel isn't just about A to B. So a lot of transport geography historically has been about A to B journeys. And it's kind of like, okay, how do we make that the fastest journey or the cheapest? But actually it's kind of about the journey as well as the destination, if you like. And so for these young people, the journey, the reasons they chose a particular way of traveling was the sociability that it afforded. And the buses, if it's universal, if all of your peer group can get the bus, then it becomes this default mode, because you can all get on that bus and you can all be sociable. So some young people say, well, my mum and dad could drive me, but I get the bus because I want to see my friends. So it's not that, so the bus then becomes a sociable mode, and then seeing the park. So you do the journey to the park, but it's not that you're on your own, you're with your friends and you're going to explore the city together. And that in part is why we argued that cycling isn't a kind of candidate mode for young people. It's not a particularly sociable mode. You're kind of cycling on your own. Walking and getting the bus together has this kind of sociability component in it. So it's kind of this interesting, the role of the kind of, not only the bus increases your speed of getting to school, but it also provides you this space to be sociable, to just talk to people. So young people would say to us, I get on the bus, one of the things we do is we talk to each other. So it becomes this kind of sociable space.
So one of the other concerns around the ZIP scheme was that it would increase antisocial behaviour, that it would, as you said, lead to gang-related violence or pushing older people off buses because they didn't want to be in the middle of all of the school kids. Was that the case at all?
Yeah, that again was hard to measure. But I mean, one of the things related to that we found, so we did a sort of a sub-study of older people in London, or a kind of related study, a smaller one, and they have a Freedom Pass, which is like, I think, the gold card here. So the Freedom Pass gives older people free travel, not only on the buses and trams, but also most train services and the London Underground. And so we were interviewing them about their use of those cards, and we were intrigued by what the kind of interaction, if you like, between young people and older people was. And it didn't seem to be that there were kind of reports of, oh, there's young people flooding the buses and displacing us. And in fact, I think it was a kind of negotiation. So the older people, for most of their journeys, would kind of choose, and understandably, to travel after peak time. So after school travel times and after rush hour for people who work. And so there was a kind of just the bus, I guess the conflicts weren't there really, because they were using the systems at different times of the day. So these kind of these conflicts that people predicted might happen didn't seem to materialize in our analysis of that. But that's a kind of, there probably is more research to be done on that kind of particular relationship.
But as I understand it, you can have your zip card rescinded if you are perceived to be engaging in antisocial behaviour.
Yes, absolutely. So it's interesting. So the Freedom Pass for older people, you get in your kind of this little plastic wallet. The zip card, you get in a plastic wallet. My son's actually got one. He's 7. And then you open it up and it has all these rules about kind of how you use the transport system, in particular about antisocial behaviour. So there's a kind of I think it's called an antisocial behaviour code for young people. Don't play your music too loud, those sorts of things. And so they have a list of reasons for why they can have their zip card removed. And in a few instances of people we interviewed, either they or their friends had their zip cards taken away for some reason. And in those, it was very interesting, because suddenly they reported, actually, that really was restrictive. to our social activities or to our friends' social activities. They, you know, they weren't able to do the things with us that they had been able to previously. And this kind of demonstrated to us the importance of the kind of the universality of the scheme, and that actually, because the evidence didn't suggest that there was a kind of change before and after in who was going to school. So I think you talked about school attendance. There didn't seem to be a change in that in the school travel patterns, but our qualitative data suggested that for the kind of more discretionary journeys that people might do at weekends to social activities, this card became really important. So maybe it's that in a household, people prioritize paying for their kid to get to school, but they don't prioritize paying for their kid to go to the cinema on a Sunday or whatever. But if you have this free scheme, you can do it. And then you start to see how having your card taken away suddenly puts a stop to some of those activities if you can't afford the bus otherwise. So yeah, that was interesting. So they can, yeah, there is this antisocial behavior code that they have.
I think it's interesting that they extended it to, built into it a 7-day accessibility model, that it becomes then more about those social relationships than just about school attendance. But talking about the universality and accessibility, looking at the study, that was one of the things that did come up, was the question of the accessibility of public transport for differently abled people.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we argued in our kind of approach, where we're trying to use the qualitative data to understand, say, the capacity of an intervention to have a particular change on the population. So in this instance, the capacity for the intervention to not lead to a decline in active travel. And one of the things we argued is that actually through the qualitative data, we could see that it was very important for the transport system to be accessible and reliable. So you could have a free bus scheme, but if you don't have any buses, it's not going to really make a difference. People are, you know, after a few days, look, the bus is late every day, or I get to school late, you revert back to the car. But if you have a scheme where, you know, the bus is fairly reliable, you know, you're not going to have to wait more than a few minutes to get your bus. You can reasonably predict how long it's going to take you to get into school or to work. Then the system can work because you can rely on it. And one of the things that we found as kind of evidence of this, of the importance of the bus system being accessible and kind of reliable, is that for young people with physical disabilities, they didn't talk to us about how the bus became this sociable space. In fact, they didn't really get the bus because they found that sometimes the wheelchair ramps to get on the bus weren't working, which, you know, then it doesn't matter if the system's reliable if you can't get on the bus. Sometimes there wasn't space for a wheelchair. So they have this kind of shared space on buses, people use for buggies, and there's a kind of priority area. But often that's taken up by other people, and people won't necessarily move. You know, there ought to be kind of more of a hierarchy of need, I guess. So there's that. And then also there's just space for one wheelchair, so you can't socialise in the same way. So as soon as the bus system becomes, as soon as there are kind of problems with the accessibility of that system, they still have the card, but they just don't use it because the system isn't accessible. It doesn't meet their needs in terms of access. It isn't reliable for them. They don't know that they can get that bus that comes because the ramp might not work, or there might not be the space. So yeah, so that was a kind of a case in our data, and I think qualitative data is good at this, suddenly showing you, okay, well maybe it works in all of these instances, but sometimes it doesn't work. What's breaking down there? What's not working? And we argued that it was the accessibility issue. And I think you can extend that argument to say that, okay, so if the bus system is inaccessible in a sense of not easy to use or not reliable for the wider population, then that scheme's probably not going to have the same effects, because people just aren't going to change their behaviour to use a system that they can't rely on.
So thinking about those things that inhibit the scheme and the things that promote the scheme, what do you think is most important? If you were looking at instigating a similar scheme elsewhere, what would you consider the most important factors in promoting public transport use?
It's a good question. So I think here the universality of the scheme for... for the whole population, that's probably financially a massive investment. So, but for young people or for older, you know, so if you have these schemes where you think, okay, actually, we're going to target this population. And I think part of the reason for targeting young people is thinking, well, maybe it's going to have a change on their behavior. So if we're looking forward, if we get people, young people, to shift and not feel that the bus is something that they would never ride, but actually it's this thing that enables them to be social, enables them to be independent. So on the one hand, having this kind of universality of the scheme, I think that's very important, so that people have, that there aren't these in these barriers to use, which come kind of from a financial constraint or from, oh, well, I my parents will drive me there because I'll have to pay for the bus anyway. Even if you have enough money, you know, to use the bus, you might not decide to use it because it's not universal and it's actually cheaper in your head as a young person to get a lift with your parents. So there's other costs to that. So I think having that kind of universality of the scheme, and then actually it's the kind of, it's the network, the system itself, that it's reliable, that you can use it. So I don't think there's much good in implementing a free bus scheme if you can't rely on the buses, if the bus network is poor, if it just serves certain areas and not others. And I think in London, the network is generally pretty good. It's kind of extensive and it goes kind of radially and also in and out of the city. So you can kind of connect and you can get from one place to another relatively easily by changing buses. And I suppose for school travel, it tends to be relatively short journeys. It's not like you're traveling across the whole city to go to school. But I think having that kind of reliable, extensive network is also important as a kind of precondition for the scheme being effective in terms of changing transport behaviours.
So from a public health perspective, would you recommend it as a policy intervention based on the mixed methods research that you've done evaluating its success in London?
Yes, I think I would. I guess the one question mark, and I come from an active travel background, is a kind of around the cycling, the change in cycling. So that's a hard one, because I think, you know, the evidence from our study was that cycling is a very small amount of cycling among young people to school that took place anyway, and then there was a decrease in that after the intervention. So, but from a kind of walking perspective and a more holistic active travel sector, if we took in everything rather than just focus on cycling, which sometimes, you know, there's a lot of policy towards encouraging cycling at the moment in the UK anyway, and I think there's probably more here as well. I don't know too well, but in if we take a more holistic view about, okay, so let's not just focus on the cycling, but think about people's attitudes to travel generally and how they might be shifting towards more physically active modes and more sustainable, kind of environmentally sustainable modes as well, and about the kind of levels of active travel they're doing walking, and then about other health impacts like social inclusion, which are important. They're not so sometimes these evaluations become caught up in the kind of the physical activity effects of a given intervention, but I think the free bus scheme has effects that go much beyond that, to kind of a social inclusion, accessing education and stuff, which have more harder to kind of measure, more indirect effects on health, but that are important effects. So from that point of view, if we take it holistically, yes, I think it is an intervention that I think works in the right context. Yeah, so the context is key as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Any final thoughts?
The thing about car use, I guess, is the other final, because I think as well. So we were looking at it as the public health effects of this intervention, but I think there are also important kind of sustainability effects and kind of changing attitudes to car use. So it was interesting that young people would talk to us about kind of wanting to get a car when they're older, or that kind of the independence that would afford and the kind of status, if you like. But if you kind of read their accounts in a very direct way, you might think, okay, well, it hasn't changed car use at all. Perceptions about car use and attitudes towards driving. But actually, if you kind of go to the data in a much more inductive way and kind of read it through, then you start to see actually, but the way they're talking about the bus isn't that it's this mode that stigmatizes, as I talked about right at the start. It's not a mode that they think, oh, I can't wait till I don't have to use the bus. In fact, they're talking about everyone using the bus. And I think that's also important as a kind of indicator of attitudes to bus use. And actually, these claims about cars maybe kind of fit into a kind of broader representation or whatever of the car, the kind of norms about car use. But it seemed from the data that actually there was also a normalization of bus use. And I think that's really important for kind of shifting behavior. So it suddenly doesn't become this thing that's something you're just not familiar with, that you don't do. Actually, you're very familiar with it. You understand how the bus can be the sociable space and so on. And maybe it will, we can only see with it over time, but I think my sense would be that actually it will cause a shift away from car use among this kind of cohort as they go through their lives. But we'll see. And I guess the one other thing I'd like to add is kind of to bring this discussion back to the research that I'm currently doing at the University of Auckland, which is funded by the National Centre for Research Methods in the UK. And to think about how the work that I was involved in on the buses project helps us to think about the uses of qualitative data in realist evaluations that are done in observational settings. So I'm interested in looking more broadly in kind of research related to the buses study I was involved in, at how researchers have used qualitative methods in mixed methods evaluations to kind of make a contribution to their findings, to think about how their findings might be transferred to other settings. So I'm interested in how qualitative data in those sorts of studies are used to look at the context of a given intervention, are used to help us interpret the causal mechanisms between an intervention and a set of outcomes, and also help us to kind of fill in gaps in the quantitative data that we've collected. And I'm also interested in if there are other ways that researchers have used qualitative data in these sorts of mixed methods evaluation studies. So ultimately, I think it's about, for me anyway, using this buses research as a kind of prompt to start thinking about, okay, how more broadly might we help researchers methodologically to optimize their use of qualitative research methods in mixed methods evaluations of policies and interventions.
Thank you very much
for
your time.
Thank you very much. Cheers.